You don't need to, don't feel constrained at all because it picks up pretty well. So I'm just going to stick it in the middle here and then that'll be fine. But feel free to wander around all over the place.
Right. So if I time this to about sort of 1:45.
Do you want to,
I time this to about 1:45.
Yeah, perfect. That's absolutely perfect. And then we'll give them about 10 minutes or something like that. See, hopefully we won't lose too many en route. You can have a double espresso. We'll just wait a moment and see if we get anybody else before we start.
Edinburgh through and through, which makes it all the more painful when they tell me I'm not allowed to work with them anymore. we used to live in Fife, and Edinburgh would be the first sort of city I remembered as a boy.
No, right.
Falklands.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm obviously from St Andrews, so
Yeah, so, and I went to school in England, and then and then as soon as I was able to, I came straight back up.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
Then,
okay.
Yeah, so.
Rightly so.
Been here ever since.
Falkland. Kind Kittick's Kitchen.
Falkland?
Well, Kind Kittick's Kitchen has been closed now, but whenever we went on family trips, it was to Falkland. It used to do, they used to do pancakes.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
Overlooking that kind of wee grassy triangle.
Yes. I don't know if it's still there.
I suspect it's not still there.
I wonder.
It wasn't,
actually.
It wasn't the sort of hub of culinary.
No, there's a few big cafes and things, so I haven't been back for ages, mind, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was the old sort of bric-a-brac antique shop on the corner.
Yeah.
That's still there.
Nope, lost
them. Looked and decided they didn't.
Okay, everybody, thanks for coming. Thanks, well done, your first challenge for the day in finding here. Before we get going, I'm just going to do my usual roll call of reminders about events and things like that. Your registers are sitting down here at the front, so if you could try and sign them at half time or at the end, that would be great. Honours students, your handout for next week is also down here at the front if you want to pick that up. Does everybody have a copy of the slides? Shout if you don't. Okay. I think the slides that we will be looking at today will be slightly different, but you can use, but only in a couple of small respects. So you can use the slides that you've got today, and then the version that we talk to today will go up on the course pages probably on Monday. Okay. But anyway, just a quick reminder, other things before we get going. Tonight's script seminar is by Sven Boston from the University of Liverpool, talking about is there a future for absolute product patent protection, looking particularly at gene technologies, gene inventions, genetic inventions, and evaluating that in the light of that. So that's tonight, 6 o'clock in Lecture Theatre 183. And then on Tuesday, we have another script seminar by Professor Duncan Matthews of Queen Mary University London on the TRIPS Agreement Doha 10 years on, reflecting on TRIPS agreement and public health from a human rights perspective. So that's Tuesday the 13th, also 6 o'clock in Lecture Theatre 183. Also, the Conversations on Copyright series, I think I told you before, I'm reminding you again, Lionel Bentley on the 22nd of March. That's up on your course web pages, so please don't forget about that. And that's everything. Is that everything? Master's students, next week, after this afternoon's class, will be the poster event where you get to see each other's posters. So 4:30, don't shake your head, it'll be wonderful. So don't forget that. That's after the afternoon class in room LO5. Otherwise, next week, obviously, we're back to the same time, same place, usual setup for everyone. A final thing is, of course, don't forget the practice moot by your mooting team, Seth and Nadia, which is Wednesday at 4. At 4. Okay, that's the roll call of events and diary management, etc. So today, patents and biotechnology. I'm delighted to welcome Richard Gibbs from Marks and Clark Patent Agents. Richard is a proper Edinburgh boy, having done his degree here, PhD here, postdoc here, and also been a lecturer here in the School of Biology, specialising in immunology.
Yes,
is that your area?
Right.
Before going off and turning into a patent agent and working at Marks and Clark, specialising in biotechnology patenting in particular. And he's done work with all of the Scottish universities, most of the Scottish universities,
all of them.
Many universities. Really delighted to have him here today to help all of us, including me, through the technology. So I think what we're going to do is go for about 40 minutes or so, 40, 45 minutes, take a break and then do the second half of the class. But Richard is happy to take questions at any time, and we'll take a moment for questions before we break, and then again at the end. Okay? So in that case, I will let you get on with it.
Yeah, please, if as I go through this, if there's anything you want to ask, just please shout out. We'll be going through a bit of sort of biotechnology and trying to put everything in context. So again, if there's anything about the technology you don't understand, please feel free to ask. I might not be able to explain it any better, but I'll try. So I was a lecturer at the medical school in immunology for a while, and I was always taught never to start a lecture with an apology, so I'm going to start with two. As Jane said, my handouts have slightly changed, not in a materially significant way, but there are some things I wanted to sort of reorder and address better, so I've made the appropriate changes to the handout. And secondly, you might get a flash of a blood stain on my shirt as I speak. Please don't worry, I wasn't in a fight or anything. My son this morning decided to have a nosebleed over me, and I was too far away from home to correct, so apologies for that. Okay, patents in biotechnology. It's a big field. Biotechnology covers a huge array of different things. And unlike mechanical devices, there are certain questions about whether biotechnology can be patented, because the things that constitute products in biotechnology are somewhat undefined. They're brand new. They're constantly evolving. And there are lots of questions to be asked as to, you know, what is the invention here? Is it a product? Is it a method? Is it a product made by a particular method? All these questions come up regularly in the field of biotechnology. And biotechnology patents can cover anything from new medical treatments, and in that regard, they can cover compounds, and those compounds can be proteins, they can be antibodies, they can be nucleic acids, DNA or RNA, they can be cells, per se, an actual cell, or they can be a specific type of cell, for example, a stem cell. And there can be a lot of sort of emotive issues wrapped up in the field of biotechnology, because within all of these things, there can be real and proper treatments for serious diseases, or diagnostic methods for allowing people to detect the onset or predisposition to disease. So patents can also include diagnostic tests. They can include methods for making proteins. They can include methods for making nucleic acids. And in addition to that, we can have patents or inventions that concern animals or plants, particularly in the field of crop research, where there's a real need to provide plants which are drought-resistant, disease-resistant, respond better to feed, have different properties, and animal models as well. So all of these things can be protected by way of patents, or at least people try to get patents to protect these things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of take some snapshots of bits of technology, try and educate you about the technology, and talk a bit about some of the issues that have plagued the patentability of these things. So we'll start, however, with a sort of summary of the law, and I appreciate that you're probably familiar with this, but I thought it would be best to start just to make sure that everything is in its proper context. So in the UK, in order to get a patent, your invention has to be new, it has to be inventive, and it has to be capable of industrial application. Those three things. In addition to that, however, there's a sort of subsection of Section 1 of the 1977 Patent Act that says that some things are specifically excluded from patentability, and therefore your invention must not sit with one of those within one of those excluded categories. They include business methods, mental acts, discoveries, algorithms, computer programs, interestingly. What are computer programs protected by? Anybody know? Yeah, copyright. So the law of copyright covers computer programs per se. What that means is that somebody couldn't just write out a string of code and get a main claim and a patent to that. So mustn't be excluded. In addition to that, we have these further two layers of complication, in that the invention mustn't be one the commercial exploitation of which would be contrary to public policy or morality. And in addition to that, we specifically exclude methods of treatment of the human or animal body by surgery or therapy, and methods of diagnosis practiced on the human or animal body. Okay. The position in Europe is almost identical, although the framework of the legislation is different. We go from sections to articles. Article 52 says that in order to be patentable, something must be new, inventive, and capable of industrial application. So that mirrors the wording of the UK Patent Act. You've got the list of excluded subject matter, which is again almost identical to that which I said for the UK Act. And in addition, you've got this Article 53, which says that things contrary to order public or morality, plant or animal varieties, or essentially biological processes for the production of plants or animals are not patentable. And methods for the treatment of the human or animal body by surgery or therapy, and diagnostic methods practiced on the human or animal body are also not patentable. So, just going back to this section here, contrary to order public or morality, the typical example we give is that something like a letter bomb is absolutely capable of patent protection. You can have a novel detonation mechanism. It can be inventive because the mechanism wasn't obvious. There's something clever about it. It's more sensitive or whatever. But morally, it wouldn't be right to give a patent to that. So things like letter bombs and mine detonations, things like that, are usually excluded under Article 53. But in biotechnology, there are questions as to whether inventions it's morally right to protect them. Now, in an attempt to sort of harmonize what is and what isn't patentable within the field of biotechnology, back in 1998, the Directive 9844EC of the European Parliament was passed, and Article 5 of that directive stated that the human body at its various stages of formation and development and the simple discovery of one of its elements, including the sequence or partial sequence of a gene, cannot constitute a patentable invention. So that's a fairly clear statement that part of the human body cannot form the basis of a patentable invention. However, an element isolated from the human body by means of a technical process, including the sequence or partial sequence of a gene, may constitute a patentable invention, even if the structure of that element is identical to that of a natural element. So if there's been a lot of research behind finding a particular gene and what it does and isolating it from the human body, there's been recombinant technology involved, then perhaps you might be able to get a patent, provided it's not simply a random and unannotated chunk of DNA that you're trying to get a patent for. And in order to ensure that you comply with the need to demonstrate that a gene has an industrial application, you must in your patent somewhere put the industrial application of the sequence or partial sequence of the gene in your patent application. So you can get a patent to a gene sequence, but you must somewhere in your patent tell the reader what the gene is being used for. Article 6 sets out a further string of things which are not patentable under the morality provisions. And it says that these morality provisions are intended to exclude processes for cloning human beings, processes for modifying the germline genetic identity of human beings, uses of human embryos for industrial or commercial purposes, and processes for modifying the genetic identity of animals, etc., which are likely to cause them suffering without any substantial benefit to man. Okay? So again, there's a string of things here which are not to be patentable under the remit of biotechnology. So that directive was passed, and every national state was required to implement that in some shape or form. Now, before the European Patent Office, they implemented it as Article 53, which is the morality exclusion, and Rule 28, which essentially replicated the wording of Article 6 and 5. In the UK Patent Act, Section 1.3 has the morality exclusion, and Schedule 2 of the 77 Patent Act, again, replicates the wording of Article 5 and Article 6 of that directive. So it's firmly embedded in our statute. Okay, so I want to just now focus on a particular type of biotechnology and the issues that this raised. And as I say, as we go along, please feel free to involve yourself in any kind of discussion about the rights and wrongs of getting these things protected. So this patent, EP705903, concerned cancer diagnosis. In fact, the diagnosis of breast and ovarian cancer. Now, to put it into context, we have here a string of nucleic acid. And nucleic acid is divided into what's called codons. A codon comprises three nuclear bases. This codon, GGA. Now, GGA is the code for a particular amino acid, in this case, an amino acid called glycine, which we can represent by a G. So the human body provides these strings of nucleic acids. They code for a string of amino acids or proteins. And here we have a protein string, which is coded for by this nucleic acid sequence here. Now, in this little sequence I've provided here, there are two C residues, C for cysteine. Now, cysteine is a very clever amino acid. It is able to cause proteins to fold and loop together because it's got sulfur atoms in it, and they can produce these disulfide bridges here. So in this case here, this amino acid sequence encodes this protein, which folds via the two C residues in this particular way. Okay? And unless it folds in that way, it can't function, because you can imagine how this might form a part of a jigsaw which fits into another protein. Okay, so it has to adopt that shape in order to fit with another protein to cause a particular cellular process to occur. If that cellular process doesn't occur, then cancer may result, cancer being the uncontrolled proliferation of a cell. Okay? So in this case, this has to happen for cancer not to occur. Now, what the applicant discovered was that in a particular gene called the BRCA gene, there was a mutation. So here's the nucleic acid I showed you before. But in this case, this G residue here had been replaced by a C residue. And what that meant was that this codon no longer encoded cysteine, it encoded serine. And because the C's were replaced by S's, essentially this bond here, which would normally occur, couldn't form, and the protein can't fold. So because the protein can't fold, it can't interact with the things it's supposed to interact with, and therefore cancer results. Okay? So what they were wanting to do was to try and exploit that in some way. The finding that there is a mutation in a particular gene which leads to cancer is a useful finding. Because one, if you can stop that mutation occurring, you might be able to stop cancer. Two, it forms the basis of a diagnosis. If people present to you either with a fear that they have cancer or a fear that they are predisposed to cancer, you can screen their DNA. And if you identify that mutation, you can either explain to them that yes, they may have cancer, or they are predisposed to getting cancer. So it has a real and definite utility. So what the applicant tried to do in this case, in a patent that was entitled In Vivo Mutations and Polymorphisms in the 17q Linked Breast and Ovarian Cancer Susceptibility Gene, they tried to claim an isolated nucleic acid. And that isolated, I put the actual wording of the claim here, an isolated nucleic acid coding for a mutant or polymorphic BRCA1 polypeptide. Okay, so that's a piece of nucleic acid taken outside the human body. That's the first part of the claim. The nucleic acid containing, in comparison to a reference sequence, in this case the sequence they provided is seq ID number 1, one or more mutations or polymorphisms. Okay, so a mutation is what I just explained before, a specific change in the sequence. A polymorphism includes there are natural variations in everybody's DNA throughout the whole population. Nobody here has the same DNA. And even within a particular gene, there may be differences in the actual coding sequence of the DNA. But hopefully, they all work, the proteins that are produced all work in the same way. But what they tried to cover within this claim was not only mutations, but also polymorphisms, these natural variations that occur in the population. So there's two things we have to consider here. One, the European Patent Office's job is to work out whether the invention is novel, it's inventive, and it's capable of industrial application. And as you know, when they receive the patent application, the first thing they do is examine it to make sure it fulfills those three criteria. If it does, you get a patent. If it doesn't, you don't. So in the examination, the first thing the European Patent Office did was they looked at the novelty of the claim. It's always the first thing. And they said that this claim lacks novelty, because essentially it encompasses known sequences. There were already papers out there which claimed variations and mutations in that gene. Those papers didn't know what the mutations and variations did, but remember, this is a claim to an isolated nucleic acid having various alterations in it. And as far as the examiner could see, was that was already known. So in order to get around that objection, the applicant simply deleted from the scope of the claim the stuff that was known. Okay, that's a fairly standard approach. And that immediately restores novelty to the claim. So the examiner revisits the claim and says, okay, I see what you've done. You've taken away all the stuff I had found that was fell within the scope of your claim, and now it's novel. So then he moves on and says, okay, the next thing I have to do is look at inventive step. So in this case, he said, in terms of inventive step, I accept that you have a novel piece of DNA, but what I don't accept is that there's anything technical associated with that piece of DNA. What he's trying to do is say that you haven't fulfilled the criteria of being able to tell me what it's used for, okay? He's essentially saying there's no inventive step here. All you've done is isolate a piece of DNA from the human body, albeit you found a piece with mutations in it. So again, to address this objection, the applicant came back and essentially limited the claims to a specific cohort of mutations, which in their application they had proved were associated with cancer. And then they were able to go back and say, okay, we've narrowed the scope of our claim. We no longer encompass things that are known. We no longer encompass things that aren't associated with cancer. Our claim is now directed to specific gene mutations which are associated with breast cancer. And therefore, the utility is that they can be used potentially in the treatment of cancer, or this knowledge could be used in the treatment of cancer, or more probably in the diagnosis of cancer. Okay. And they were granted their patent. The actual prosecution involved a narrowing of the claims quite considerably from that general isolated nucleic acid claim I gave you to one which said an isolated nucleic acid comprising, and they numbered some very specific part of their reference sequence. Okay, so it wasn't the whole thing anymore, it was a bit of it. Having one or more of the following mutations, the first one or one of them was this mutation here. And this notation means that at position 64, the cysteine residue has been replaced with an arginine. So wherever you find that, cancer may result or may be apparent. Okay, so and there were a whole string of these mutations. So the claim is very much more restricted, but it's still to a piece of DNA with mutations in it. Okay, they have a monopoly on that. Nobody can make, use, or sell it without their permission. In addition, they had a very useful claim here to a method for diagnosing a breast lesion of a human for neoplasia associated with the BRCA1 gene, comprising determining whether there is a mutation in the BRCA1 sequence. And then again, they listed the specific mutations. So in addition to having a monopoly on the nucleic acid itself, they were also able to secure a monopoly for a method of using that nucleic acid, or the information they were giving about the mutations in it, in the diagnosis of cancer. And as we know, or as you may know, the BRCA1 gene is one of the foremost causes of breast cancer, or having it really predisposes women to getting breast cancer, and therefore there is a lot locked up in this patent. There's a lot of potential good locked up in the patent, and you know, people can't necessarily access it to develop it while Myriad have a monopoly over the whole thing. So the second part, however, of the patent process in most territories is that after examination, there's a period where the patent can be opposed, where third parties can step in and challenge the European or British patent, or the European Patent Office's view that the claims are novel, inventive, have industrial application, and a whole host of other things. So, not surprisingly, this patent was opposed by lots and lots of people. The opponents raised objections under Article 52, so saying, look, it's still not novel. It doesn't matter that they've restricted it. They find prior art which discloses all of the same mutations that are enclosed in this claim. It's still not inventive because it was perhaps already known that this gene was associated with cancer, arguments of that type. But in addition to that, the opponents tend to make a lot more of the Article 53A objections, the contrary to morality and ordre public, than the European Patent Office do. And you get a lot of opponents raising objections under this article, citing that it's simply not a patentable invention. It is a piece of nucleic acid. And you saw that in Article 5 of that directive I showed you before, there was a specific exclusion to pieces of nucleic acid isolated from the human body. Okay. Sort of suggesting that they're actually just discoveries. They're always there. You've just sort of found them. So yes, they were trying to say that these weren't sort of patentable objections under this. But in the opposition proceedings, all of these arguments were dismissed because they pointed out that with this decision here, T27295, and in combination with Rule 29 EPC, which is one of those rules that were put in to harmonize what was and wasn't patentable in the field of biotechnology following Article 5 and Article 6 of that directive, it simply says that an element isolated from the human body or otherwise produced by means of a technical process, including the sequence or partial sequence of a gene, may constitute a patentable invention, provided you have disclosed the industrial application in the application. And they had. They had fulfilled all of those. Not only had they isolated the DNA by means of a technical process, it wasn't straightforward, it wasn't routine laboratory work. They had analyzed the mutations that were present. They had screened samples to work out which mutations were associated with cancer and which weren't. And they had taken the time to verify those. And in addition to that, they had disclosed that this was useful in the diagnosis of cancer. Therefore, as far as the European patents were concerned, they had fulfilled all of their criteria. And so even after opposition, the patent was allowed. Again, I've sort of embedded the final form of claim that was granted. For reasons of lack of novelty and inventive step, they lost some of those isolated nucleic acid claims. It wasn't because they were deemed not patentable inventions, it was for other reasons. So claim one shifted from being a claim to an isolated nucleic acid to a method of diagnosing a predisposition for cancer, comprising looking for this alteration in the gene, okay? So a very much more narrow claim than they'd started out with, but if that is the mutation that causes breast cancer, then it's a very valuable patent. It doesn't matter that it's severely narrow in scope. If it claims the way you have to diagnose breast cancer, it does its job. Okay? Yes?
Sorry, how does the Article 6 exception for exclusion of methods of diagnosis apply to this?
Yes, good question. So, a method of diagnosing a subject should also be excluded from patentability. The reason you get around it is, let me see if I can find it, in a tissue sample of said subject, okay? So long as the method of diagnosis isn't performed in the person and the person has to be there during the procedure, you can get round the exclusion by saying, actually what you're doing is you're doing it in a sample, a bit of somebody. I would say that this claim hasn't been worded terribly well because it doesn't specify that the tissue sample isn't in the person. Now, what you really should have is, in your claims, you should have an in vitro method or a method comprising the step of providing a sample from a patient. So even then, by saying, I know it sounds tortuous wording, but providing a sample from a patient actually removes you as having to take something from somebody. They're giving you it. So even you haven't even done it yourself. You know, you've been given a sample from somebody and then you've conducted the test on that sample. But the rule is, if the person doesn't have to be present and the diagnostic procedure doesn't have to occur on the person, then you can, by clever claim wording, you can get around that exclusion. Okay? But as I say, I don't think that claim's terribly well worded. I still think that includes doing that diagnostic method on a person, which you're quite right, for those reasons, wouldn't be patentable. And it's, you know, during oppositions, it's always useful to sort of just, you know, the more restrictions you can get into a claim, the better. So it's actually surprising that somebody didn't sort of try and hammer them down on that point there and get the word in vitro put in, you know, or something. Because what we're actually trying to do is, obviously, we can never be in a position where in the UK, a doctor approaches a patient and says, you need this life-saving procedure. Oh, sorry, I can't do it. I haven't taken the license to the patent, you know, and the NHS hasn't, so we can't, you know, we can't be in that position. So that's why, you know, our claims generally don't start a method of, okay, because that supposes that sort of encroaches into the hospital setting. We have conducting it outside the human body or an in vitro method and things like that. It's the same actually for drugs. So you can get a claim to a new use of a compound for treating a disease. But you can't get a claim to a method of treating a disease comprising administering somebody a drug. Okay, so you have to word it slightly differently to get around those exclusions. Okay. So on this point here of an element isolated from the human body and the need to disclose some sort of industrial application in the patent, there's been a recent decision on this very point.
Eli Lilly and Co versus HGS. Now this concerned EP0939804, and it was a patent to a gene encoding a novel protein. Okay, so very much the same as the breast cancer patent, a claim to an isolated gene which encoded a protein which did some sort of useful job. Now, in this case, the protein was this protein called neutrokine alpha. Okay, so in your body, your immune system relies on a whole array of different chemicals and compounds to make sure that the immune response occurs properly and does its job. Neutrokine alpha is one of these molecules. It controls the way your T cells work, okay, the cells that fight off infection. It tells them what to do. It tells them when to expand. It tells them when to contract. It does all these sort of things. But the point here was, and you see it an awful lot with patents that come from the US, there was absolutely no experimental data in the patent at all. Okay, one of the things that, you know, in my job, when I do, when I write patents for the university, and I get given draft scientific papers to base patents on, I always look at the data because I want to see that they've actually done, they've made an invention, they've done it. They're not just sort of putting out theories and thinking about how things might work. They've actually really done the science and proved that if they add A to B, C happens, okay? And a patent examiner wants to see the same thing. He wants to open a patent document and see that they've done the they've done the research and that what they're examining is a real patent to a real product, not just guesswork and supposition. And patents from the US tend to be automatically generated. There's a lot of stock boilerplate text. And what happens is somebody comes to you and says, look, we think we're on the verge of discovering a new protein. It's called neutrokine alpha. Neutrokine alpha is a member of a family of proteins which we know a lot about. This is just a new type of neutrokine. Okay, we're going to call it neutrokine alpha. Neutrokine 1, 2, 3 are already known. And because neutrokine 1, 2, 3 are already known, and we've come up with neutrokine alpha, which looks very similar but is different, we think it does all the same jobs. So just write us a patent. Here's the data we've got which shows we're almost on the verge of getting it. If you could just write a whole load of stuff in there that sort of talks about what it might do, that would be great. Okay, and you get these patents. They're hundreds of pages long, and they've just got stock text in them. And you can open another patent and look at page 23, and it's got the same stuff in it because it's all just churned out stuff. There's no sort of, it's not based on real data, so each patent isn't unique as they should be. And then this is one of these patents. And in fact, the text was so sort of stock and repetitive that it contradicted itself in places. At one point it says, this protein causes T cells to rapidly multiply. And in the very next paragraph it said, this protein causes T cells to rapidly decrease in number. Okay, and it sort of had different and opposite jobs. It was strange. And the judges were finding it very difficult to work out whether there was a real and bona fide use that had been attached to this protein. As it happened, it all worked out fine because there were crucial parts where, fine, they hadn't actually done the research to work out whether this was true or not, but it proved to be the case. They had written that the protein exhibits activity on leukocytes, including, for example, monocytes, active in directing proliferation, differentiation, and migration of these cell types. So there was a general reference to how this protein might be used in medicine or industry. And the judgment said that, you know, the description, it delivers sufficient technical information to satisfy the requirement of disclosing the nature and purpose of the invention and to show how it can be used in the industrial practice. So long as there is something in your patent that says how something might be used, you are more than likely going to satisfy the requirement that you demonstrate that something is industrially applicable. So coming back to nucleic acids, so long as it's novel, so long as it's inventive, and so long as you've put a scintilla of a use into your application, you are more than likely going to get a granted patent. And it really doesn't matter that the gene is involved in cancer, involved in a devastating form of cancer, and that it holds the key to diagnosing that cancer, and that by granting a monopoly to that applicant, you are essentially preventing certain areas of the world from accessing that technology or certain people from accessing that technology. That doesn't matter. That's not a consideration in this case, and it wasn't a consideration in the BRCA gene cases, even though the opponents tried to make out that it was immoral to patent that type of technology. Okay? So I just thought I'd remind you, Article 6 here, and in particular Part D, where it says that processes for modifying the genetic identity of animals which are likely to cause them suffering without any substantial medical benefit to man or animal, and also animals resulting from such processes. Okay? So in addition to cancer, the other topic that invokes strong emotions is animals and cruelty to animals, and patents and technology which combine the two, certainly. And this is one of those patterns that combine the two, cancer and animals. EP0169672. Anybody heard of the Oncomouse? The Harvard Oncomouse? Yeah. No, that is a good one, the one with the ear on its back. I've actually, my next one sort of touches on the one with the ear on its back. The one with the ear was a demonstration of how human cartilage could be grown in a mouse to any sort of shape. I think they implanted a mesh scaffold underneath the skin of the mouse, and it was programmed to deposit cells of a particular type onto that mesh, chondrocytes that make the tough, resilient, flappy stuff, foldy stuff in your ears, and they got an ear. Everyone seen the picture with the human ear on the back of the mouse? Yeah. Okay. No, that's not this one. This is the Harvard Oncomouse. A mouse model which allowed the study of cancer. It was a mouse that had cancer. And if you threw drugs at the mouse, you could test whether the drugs worked. If you threw diagnostic procedures at the mouse, you could tell whether the diagnostic procedures worked. But it's fair to say the mouse was fairly moribund. The claim 19, a transgenic non-human mammalian animal whose germ cells and somatic cells, so the germ cells are the very precursor cells, the cells that generate every cell in your body. The somatic cells are your adult cells, okay? So in my bone marrow, I have progenitor cells that make my blood, My skin are adult skin cells, they're somatic cells. So each of these cell types in this mouse model contained an activated oncogene sequence. Every cell in that mouse's body contained a cancer gene, a gene that was programmed to cause cancer and that uncontrollably replicated cells. Okay. It contained an activated oncogene sequence as a result of a chromosomal incorporation into the animal or into the genome of an ancestor of said animal, said oncogene operationally being further defined according to anyone claims 3-10. Anyway, the important point is every cell in that animal was programmed to be cancerous. So, again, the prosecution, okay? The European Patent Office is concerned, is it novel, is it inventive, is it capable of industrial application? And they may think about Article 53, is it moral? And in this case, they actually did. It was the first thing that they cited in the case. They said, and not what you would think, actually, they didn't say that this is a terrible invention because this mouse is suffering. They actually said that Article 53B prevents the patenting of animals per se and animal varieties. Therefore, your claim 19, which is to a transgenic non-human mammalian animal, is not patentable. Okay. They also said it's not just mice. Transgenic non-human animal, and I sort of paraphrase, but this is what they were getting at. It would be okay if it was mice, but it includes things that people get emotional about, like rabbits and, other chinchillas and stuff like that, fluffy things. That's what they said. So for those reasons, they felt that the claim shouldn't be allowed in its entirety and as it stood. In addition, though, they did point out that there was probably a moral argument to be had as to whether it was justifiable to claim a mouse. And the European Patent Office often get confused because a claim to the animal doesn't necessarily mean that the animal's being made. Their job isn't necessarily to rule on morality, really. It's to rule on novelty, inventive step. And so long as it's not the letter bomb and things like that, then they should really restrict their remit to that. But they did go into this in quite a lot of detail. Now the applicant came back and said, it's not an essentially biological process, which if you read the entirety of Article 53B, it actually says animal varieties are not patentable. And what that means is you know, the Norfolk sheep with its straight back, you know, that's an animal variety. You shouldn't be allowed a monopoly on that. There are other ways of, you know, the mere fact that you're the only owner of it and you have to sell the animal and, you know, and it can't be reproduced really without, well, unless it can be cloned. You know, that sort of gives the farmer a monopoly on that anyway. So really it was to prevent the patenting of these animal varieties. The rest of it actually talks about an essentially biological process. So the natural process of sex between a male and a female animal, you know, these sort of things are not patentable. But in this case, this was a transgenic animal created in the lab. There was nothing essentially biological about its creation. Therefore, they argued that it should, that Article 53A and 53B don't apply. And in any case, there was a huge benefit to man to be had through the patenting of this. So, what do you think? Patentable, I mean, you know, is that a justifiable, you know, you're not, the article I showed you before says that you are, so long as there's a balancing up of the suffering versus the benefit to mankind, then you're probably within the remit of patentable subject matter. So what do we think about the on-commerce? Is that a fair decision to allow a patent to that? Hands up. Who thinks that's the right decision? A patent should be allowed to that on-commerce because of the benefit that it bestows to man. Okay? Slightly less than half. Okay? Right. What about this then? A transgenic non-human mammal. So just to remind you, the patent before, the European Patent Office allowed. Okay? They allowed a patent to that. This claim, I won't go into the details, but it covers a hairless mouse. Okay? That mouse suffers. It's cold, it shivers, it's not in a healthy state. It has no hair at all. What about that? Who thinks that should be patented? What's its use for a start? Anybody think of a use for a hairless mouse? Yep. Exactly. Baldness. So treat cures for baldness, diagnosis for baldness. There's a massive market there. But that mouse suffers. Is that patentable? Do you think? Is it right to patent that? What do you think the European Patent Office did? Given that they granted the on-commerce patent, they agreed there was a benefit to be had to mankind, what do you think they did with this one? They threw it out. They said that there was not a significant benefit to be had to man. You know, there was not that same balancing up. The animal suffered, but there wasn't a benefit to be had to man. So therefore, they didn't allow that patent. I'm not sure I agree with that. So people who are going bald, it's... Yeah.
Well, if you look from the government perspective, you know, being selected about what should be granted, about which patent is more useful than another, is obviously a difficult question because it's explored in the Senate some time ago. I think that in this matter, probably government should look at what is like the basic, absolutely basic need of mankind.
But does this drive home why I say that the European Patent Office should really not dabble in morality? Because already they've got themselves into a problem where they say we can exclude patents on the basis of morality, and then they have to kind of make these difficult decisions. They have to sort of, you know, fall down on the side of cancer versus baldness, and you know, and that it's a very difficult thing to call. If they restrict themselves to novelty, inventive step, and industrial application, and then leave it to national law or national courts to decide, or just leave it out entirely. Because simply because you can get a patent for this doesn't mean that you're allowed to use it in a country. If a country says it is illegal to do work on mice, then it doesn't matter you've got a patent through the European Patent Office. You won't be allowed to do it. So, you know, there's an argument to say that the European Patent Office shouldn't concern themselves with morality. Now, on the point of the hair loss, if I told you that hair, okay, fine, hair is stuff on your head, but the back of your throat, there are these microcilia, you know, the beat on your cells that cause mucus to move up and down your gullet. The sort of things that you can find out from a hairless mouse and the way follicles don't work, you can apply to the beating cilia in your cells. And dysfunctional cilia leads to diseases, respiratory disorders. So in addition, you could argue that this mouse may have application for sort of respiratory disorders and other things that aren't just baldness. Yeah, so, you know, then when you start moving into that, you say, okay, well, you know, maybe there is an argument. I think. Sure. Yeah, good point. I wonder whether the word transgenic non-human takes it away from an essentially biological process and an animal variety per se. The word animal, when you look at 53B, it mentions plant varieties and animal varieties. And I think we're all clear on what a plant variety is. It's, you know, a blue rose, a black peony, or whatever. Okay. It has the same meaning in animals. It's intended to mean, you know, Angora rabbits and things like that. It's not intended to mean transgenic animals. And I wonder if by putting those sort of things in, they think they're taking themselves away from what would be classically defined as an animal variety. You're now into the remit of something that's not produced by an essentially biological process, which an animal variety is. It's by selective breeding and not genetic engineering. If there was a genetic engineering component, you may be able to get a claim to a genetically engineered animal which has a particular trait or benefit. And so long as it wasn't a sort of cosmetic trait, you may be able to get a patent for it. So I think by including that sort of language, they think they're getting around it. Yep. Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, exactly. And if I can't answer that, you can't answer that. How on earth did the European Patent Office expect to be able to set a threshold for suffering? There's no question that these two animals suffer. I would say that the suffering of the Onca mouse is probably worse than the suffering of the hairless mouse, but they both suffer. So either we say you're not allowed a patent to anything where an animal suffers, or they don't involve themselves in that discussion full stop. Because then you get into the difficult remit of, well, which animal suffers more? Which human benefit is more or less important? And I absolutely accept your argument that, you know, where cancer's concerned, you know, that clearly of the two conditions, the fact that cancer can be fatal and baldness rarely is, surely means that the cancer is more important, if you like. But at the same time, to people who are going bald or who have never had hair or you know, it is a distressing condition. There are autoimmune diseases which cause you to lose your hair. It's not just necessarily cosmetic male pattern baldness. There can be a real pathology associated. It's not life-threatening, but it's an autoimmune disease and your hair falls out. You know, surely these people are also entitled to try and cure those diseases, and if these kind of mouse models can be used to do that, then for the same reason that the oncomouse patent is patentable, well, why not the hairless mouse? So I was going to stop there, because I think that's about just over 40 minutes.
We've taken a 5-minute break or so, and then we'll come back to the big juicy question of stem cells. Don't forget to register at the
coffee? I'm all right, thank you.
Well,
is it one trumps the other, or is it that the directive represents the current European morality
yeah.
on stem cells?
What they're saying is,
on that kind of
the directive is intended to clarify what was always to be excluded under the morality provision.
Yeah,
sorry.
So it's effectively, that's our European.
Yes, that's it, yes. But it's solved the problems, like I say. It just spoke to me that if you see the need to sit above this. No, they don't. And, you know, and the fact that every single. Yes. You know, every country has different views on what's moral and what's not. I should have warned you that there were pictures of.
I should have had, there will be distressing images during the course of this presentation.
There are no more distressing images in this presentation.
But could you say that the Onca mouse suffers less because it probably basically totally knocked out all the time?
Possibly.
Yeah.
And I have another question, what if you would use painkillers continuously? And biologically, you would prove that there is no suffering.
I mean, don't get me wrong.
Can you do can